one of the stories highlighted this weekend's news cycle related to, unfortunately, the tragic killing of 13 Afghan civilians as a result of a drone strike. But little attention has been paid by the media to the fact that, for example, some 700 Afghan civilians were killed by Allied airstrikes in 2019. And even less attention has been paid to the individuals who have to sit in dark rooms in military bases and make the decisions that results in the deaths thousands of miles away.
So how does the act of remote warfare affect those individuals who may be pushing a button that launches a fatal drone strike just before being asked to pick up some milk on the way home? What about other jobs that we as a society don't really like to think about, much less talk about? Jobs like being a prison guard or working on the killing floor at a meatpacking plant. What are the forces that cause people to perform those jobs, and how does it affect their lives? And how are the people who do those jobs regarded by the rest of society? Author A.L. Press has taken a deep dive into the lives of those who do the essential work that nobody else wants to do in his new book, Dirty Work: Essential Jobs and the Hidden Cost of Inequality in America. We're very lucky to have Mr. Press with us this morning.
Good morning, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks so much for inviting me on the program.
Can we start by talking a little bit about what motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take to do the research? I know there are lots of interviews here.
It took a long time, and one of the reasons is that all of the forms of dirty work that that I wrote about, and I would say actually a kind of almost a defining characteristic of this kind of work, is that it's out of sight and out of mind, right? So it's basically hidden from public scrutiny. And so as a reporter, that makes things challenging. One has to kind of find ways to get the inside story, if you will. And my way to do that, my approach was to try to find the people who are on the front lines, who are doing the work, who you mentioned in your opener, drone strikes. And, you know, we I think we had a very caricatured kind of image of drone warfare as a kind of almost like playing a video game. In my interviews and in my sort of reporting on the subject, I came away with a very, very different impression. This is actually a very intense and often very troubling kind of warfare for those conducting it, for those who are actually doing it. And so the themes that are in that section of the book and in others kind of offer a portrait of this, I would say, almost a hidden class of workers in America.
Yeah, very much so. And Roger asked some really interesting questions in the intro that I want to follow up on. And maybe a good way to talk about that is you tell the story of Heather Lionbow in your book, and she is one of those remote drone pilots and workers. Tell us the story. How did she end up with this job, and how has this job affected her? And then I want to follow up that with just more of your thoughts on what's the implication to all of us in society about the ability to, for lack of a better term, sanitize war?
Yeah, I mean, I think that so Heather Lionbow is one of two people in the drone program I write about in a fair amount of depth in the book, though I also visit drone bases and talk to other people in the program and to some commanders. But in her case, she wound up as a drone operator, as an imagery analyst, actually, somewhat but by accident. She just was kind of, you know, she grew up in a town in Pennsylvania, felt like she was kind of at a dead end, and didn't know anything about the drone program at the time, and ends up at Beale Air Force Base in California, working, as I said, as an imagery analyst, and over time starts to develop symptoms of distress that sort of turn out to be quite common in the drone program, but in her case, just you know, images she couldn't get out of her mind. She described grinding her teeth at night, starting to drink too much to try to sort of put aside what she was seeing during the day, and developing real kind of moral qualms. Heather's doubts began when she saw friendlies dying, that is, fellow U.S. soldiers in missions. And, you know, that's one of the intense things about the whole drone program. It's that there's this sense of responsibility that the people in it feel to protect the lives of their fellow soldiers, even though they themselves are not there. So decisions they can make can lead to, you know, life and death consequences for other soldiers, and then, you know, through surveillance and so forth. And then, of course, there are, you know, they're in the kill chain. So there are strikes that are fired, and they see the consequences of those strikes. As you mentioned at the outset, you know, there was a recent strike where family members who turned out to be unconnected to terrorism in any way ended up dying. We as a society have kind of hidden that from view. We don't hear about it a lot, but the people in the drone program do, and it's integrally related to you know, the distress and the high intense stress. And I should say one other thing about Heather Linebaugh's story, that and one of the reasons it's in the book. All of the workers that I write about who do what I call dirty work, the dirty work in our society, you know, by and large, these are not people of privilege. We tend to delegate and sort of outsource this work to people with fewer opportunities and advantages. So in that sense, my book is about this work, but it's also very much about inequality and what it's done to us as a society.
In the introduction, you talk about the concept of moral inequality. Can you flesh that out a little more? Because I think that is a central theme of the book and was really striking to me as you went through the various people that you talked to about how often their choices to do something that nobody else wanted to do, those choices were driven by the lack of alternative opportunities.
That's right. And moral inequality, I suggest, is really the piece of the inequality puzzle that we haven't really mapped out and talked about. But we think of inequality as, you know, the distribution of wealth, or as, you know, CEOs earning hundreds of times more just per hour than the average worker. That's, you know, monetary, it's measurable. Moral inequality is the inequality of stigma, of shame, of moral injury, of doing a job that makes you feel devalued or taken for granted or even scorned in some cases. And I suggest in the book, through looking at these types of jobs, that those types of really moral and emotional burdens are concentrated among the less advantaged in our society. And the folks who have to live with those burdens, you know, it can be every bit as pernicious and difficult as, say, you know, struggling to pay the rent at the end of the month.
Yeah, no, it's a huge issue. I'm going to share a story here and then ask for your suggestions on what you think we as a society should do. And this is a story I've never shared on Mound Money before. When I was between my freshman and sophomore year of my undergraduate degree, one of the best jobs that I could find, it paid well, was actually being a garbage man in my hometown. And what was nice about being a garbage man was there's only so much garbage to pick up for the day. So you get paid for 8 hours, but if you can do that job in 4 hours instead of 8 hours, you're free for the rest of the day. And in my case, and in my buddy's case, we could go on and do a second job. And so I can feel that stigma, because there was definitely a stigma associated with my friends, with me choosing to be a garbage man for the summer. I look back at that with a great amount of pride. That was a hard job. I did it to the best of my ability. I did it well. But there definitely is a stigma associated with it. And there's a reason I don't tell that story, is there's a stigma associated with you telling that story as an adult, that you chose to do that as a teenager. Any suggestions on what we as a society can do to make that path better for the people that are in what you call dirty jobs?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, in a sense, I wrote the book and foregrounded the stories of the workers because I wanted to stress and underscore that, that to the extent people do feel, you know, in garbage, the job you did maybe felt stigmatizing, but, you know, I'm not sure it felt morally troubling. I imagine it did not, because, you know, people see, you know, that someone's got to pick up the garbage. Maybe they themselves would rather not have to do it, and it's associated with kind of lower skills and so forth. But what I would say in the case of jobs like working in the drone program or working on the kill floor of a slaughterhouse, where you're seeing animals, you know, kind of slaughtered on a kind of industrial scale, I think the emphasis in our society should be on, you know, this is not unrelated to all of us, right? The industrial food system runs the way it does to a large extent because of the demand for cheap meat. Also, of course, because some very large companies profit from it. But there's a sort of interdependency, I suggest, throughout the book between the folks doing the quote-unquote dirty work and the folks who benefit from it and tolerate it, but maybe don't want to hear too much about it. So, you know, I would suggest that the first thing we have to do is just see the role of this work in our society, see that it is, in fact, you know, part of the way we live, and you know, that America kind of runs on this. And really, the pandemic, I think, is a good time to have these conversations, because it's kind of opened all of our eyes to the division of labor in our society, right? Who does which jobs? Who gets to shelter in place? Who doesn't? Who has to risk, you know, their lives, their safety, and in the case of the jobs I look at, their well-being, to do certain forms of work?
You know, you talked about the meat packing, and that was a really interesting section of the book. The kind of conditions we all read about in high school in Upton Sinclair's The Jungle are sort of commonly thought of as being relics of the past. But, you know, talk a little bit about the modern conditions in the meatpacking industry, particularly after we saw that being designated as an essential industry, notwithstanding massive outbreaks of COVID. And of course, we like to go to the supermarket, as you say, and see nice, clean packages of meat wrapped in cellophane. Talk a little bit about how we got there and how this is something we just don't want to look at.
Yeah, I mean, and tracing it historically, it was fascinating, because the Upton Sinclair book, you know, The Jungle, which so many of us know or read in high school, it captured, you know, turn of the century conditions, really brutal. And throughout that novel, Sinclair, which is, of course, based on his actual observations of meatpacking, he talked about the assault on the dignity of the workers as well. The fact that, you know, you couldn't even find a place to wash your hands. He was really talking about the kind of dirtiness of it. Well, in the mid-century, in mid-20th century, conditions in meatpacking did improve. Wages rose. I think that was largely an extent of both government regulations, but also unions sort of fighting for better conditions. But fast forward to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and there's a return to indeed some of the conditions that Sinclair described. The line speeds get faster. The repetitive strain injuries are at some plants so high that you have 100% turnover in a single year. And in the case of one of the plants I looked at, the line speeds are running so quickly, and the sort of, you know, pressure on the workers to keep working is so intense that the female workers at this poultry slaughterhouse cannot take bathroom breaks. They do get a lunch break, but it's too crowded to go to the bathroom then. And then they literally cannot get breaks to go to the bathroom. They end up going to work, some of them, with an extra pair of pants or with a sanitary napkin. And just to imagine that is something in this country we tolerate is disturbing and deeply disturbing. And I talk in the book about how consumers have learned a lot over the years about the conditions of the animals through the labels on you know, meat and poultry, humanely raised, you know, antibiotic free, and so forth. But the labels tell us nothing about the workers, and that, I think, is troubling.
Yeah, I agree. And unfortunately, we have a few more industries we want to explore and get your thoughts on. Not unfortunately, but these are, I say that just because these are difficult stories to hear, but they're important stories for us to hear. One of the industries you talk about in your book is actually working on drilling rigs. Actually, another job that I had an offer to do, but I didn't take. What did I miss out on? You know, it's definitely perceived as a lonely occupation, but also fairly highly paid. What's life like on an oil drilling rig for the laborers?
Yeah, and I interviewed a couple of different people who did that job, who worked as roustabouts. I actually interviewed one of the first female roustabouts in offshore in Louisiana. And then I also interviewed a guy named Stephen Stone, who worked on the Deepwater Horizon rig, the one that exploded in a catastrophic accident that both caused very widespread pollution and many workers' lives were lost in that catastrophe. And, you know, on one level, the workers that I spoke to talked about the good side of it, you know, the thrill, the you know, I think it was at one point described to me as, you know, being like, you know, in a castle floating on the sea, just this sense of sort of adventure and being away from kind of the day-to-day drudgery of an ordinary job. On the other hand, very high risks of injury and safety problems. And that, as I note in the book, is again not something that's inevitable, but is very much a product of loose regulations and you know, the fact that on too many rigs there was as indeed on the Deepwater Horizon, there appeared to be a focus on profit over worker safety. And Stephen Stone, the worker who survived the Deepwater Horizon blast, he experienced, I suggest in the book, a form of moral injury from that. He wasn't physically hurt too badly, but he was deeply, deeply disoriented, and kind of lost, you know, what he said to me he lost was his sense of trust. You know, he had trusted this industry would do what was needed to kind of, you know, make sure things were safe for the people on there risking their lives. And when he sort of after the blast started reading and learning about the corners that were cut, he really felt disillusioned and kind of, you know, a slippage in his sense of trust. And that is definitely a piece of what's called moral injury, which is a central concept in my book.
And the last area that we're going to have time to touch on, but I do want to touch on it, were the stories that you talked about with respect to the life of prison guards and how we as a society have changed the role of prisons with respect to mental health. Can you talk a little bit about both of those topics in our last few minutes here?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the largest, you know, jails and prisons in the United States are not just places where people who violate the law go. They are increasingly where people with severe mental illnesses are taken. In fact, in Florida, the state I look at in depth, and I think at this point, every state in the country, the largest mental health institution is not a public hospital, it's a jail or a prison. The way that relates to the life of and the work of a prison guard is that, you know, most guards are not trained to dispense mental health services or to know what to do when someone's in the throes of a psychiatric crisis. And I think most psychiatrists would say that the worst place to take someone who is in such a crisis would be, you know, an institution where the priority is security and where people are locked up and a lot of, you know, harsh violence is taking place. And so the end result is that as a society, although we've sort of hidden it behind closed doors, we have relied on jails and prisons to do the dirty work of warehousing the mentally ill. And, you know, that has terribly dehumanizing consequences, both for the mentally ill themselves, but also for the workers.
And you talk about the difficulty and the stress that imposes on people like one guard you talked about who had seen a murder, I believe it was Harriet Krzyzkowski, I'll not pronounce it right, Krzyzkowski. Before
yes.
We go, just 30 seconds on that.
Yeah, so she was a mental health aide, and she saw and witnessed her patients. One of them was locked in a scalded shower and died there. It was really a brutal murder. But she couldn't say anything. She didn't report it, and she didn't report it because she felt if she did, the guards would retaliate against her. And that kind of moral dilemma that she experienced, unfortunately, is very common among mental health aides in prisons.
We've been talking to Isle Press about his new book, Dirty Work. We get to read a lot of books here on Mountain Money. This one is extraordinary. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.